Thank you, John. I think he's quite right too. That's that's probably the best way to look at it. So, my name's Ted, and I'm an alcoholic. And I'm sober tonight by the grace of God and the miracle of Alcoholics Anonymous. And it is indeed a pleasure and an honor for me to be here tonight back in South Dakota. I've been gone for about a year now, and being asked to share it at the conference that I've attended so many times in the fall out here in Rapid City or sometimes in Spearfish. So it's just been great to be here. And before any of the new people get any ideas about some of the service positions that we've are fortunate enough to be asked to serve in as time goes forward. I heard it from my sponsor, who is also a past regional trustee, and he explained to me when I was a new guy, and he was a trustee at that time, and he said, you know, the most important person at any AA meeting is a newcomer. And I was pretty new, so I liked to hear that. That was very true, and it still is today. And he said, from that point, you work your way up to nothing. And that's kind of that's kind of how this deal works. It's the inverted triangle theory, you know. The most important people are the people that are in the meetings, and it's the members of the groups that run Alcoholics Anonymous. It's not the Board of Trustees or the General Service Office. They are but service arms of the group, and that's the GSRs. I remember one time I was at a service conference, and one of the past delegates said, and this was when I was newly a trustee, he didn't have to explain it to me, I already knew it. I had a good sponsor that explained it to me, but he said, will all the GSRs stand up? And he had the GSRs stand up, and he said, look out there, those are all your bosses as a trustee. And that's very true. So I'm glad John wanted a funny story to start off with introducing me. And I now live, and it says on the brochure, in Minnesota, Climax, Minnesota. And I've heard about five Climax, Minnesota jokes since I got in here. I keep telling everybody, I know them all, you know, after that. The short time that I've lived there, but I'm originally from that area around the Fargo-Moorhead area, and my wife lived up there, and we live on a farm outside of that town, but a couple miles away. But just to give you, I had to tell this joke because I heard it some time ago, but up there is another town called Fertile, Minnesota, and and this is a sad story, but it's kind of funny. It made the Tonight Show. But in the local paper in Crookston, Minnesota, there had been a car accident. This lady was killed. She was from Fertile, Minnesota. That's the sad part. But the front headline in the newspaper, thereabouts on the front page, said, Fertile woman dies in Climax. So, so if you didn't know your geography, you'd misread that. You would get the meaning, but so I thought I'd better explain that in case somebody tells you that one this weekend. But once again, you know, I'm just very grateful to be here and to be able to come back to the state of South Dakota where, you know, I lived for 25 years in Aberdeen, so it's nice to be back and nice to see a lot of my old friends and a lot of new faces, too. So. And tonight what I'm going to do is just share a little bit about me. I'm going to share my story, and some of my old friends that are out there probably could tell it as well as I could, and you know, but they're going to have to suffer through one more time. That's simple, John. So, but, you know, I didn't plan on, you know, ever getting to Alcoholics Anonymous, and I don't think too many of us do. But I grew up in a very, you know, loving home. I'm the oldest of eight kids. So we had a pretty big family, and, you know, usually the oldest is supposed to set the example and go forward and be a positive, good example. Well, that wasn't the case in our family. And I had my brother a year after me kind of followed me right into Alcoholics Anonymous after a couple more years, three, four more years of his research and development after I got here. But I definitely was not a good example. I was a good example of alcoholism, and I believe for myself that I was that. I was an alcoholic long before I took that first drink. And, you know, you've heard, I'm sure, a lot of studies and different things that have gone on over the years about alcoholism. And today, you know, alcoholism is and has been for a number of years recognized as a disease. It's that simple. And, you know, the geneticists can trace back the physical sensitivity to alcohol from generation to generation. And, you know, and it may skip a generation, but they can... they're able to trace that in alcoholic's genes. And I think that for me, I don't have any problem believing that at all because I truly believe that I was born an alcoholic. my thought process and my actions and everything else, you know, that I had growing up and the things I did before I took that first drink, I knew I was different than the normal people that were around me. I knew that for sure. I knew I was different than a lot of the kids, my, you know, siblings, brothers and sisters. Some of them were like me, but, you know, I knew I was different. But when I got to Alcoholics Anonymous and I heard you share what it was like for you, and before you took that first drink, I could identify immediately. I didn't want to, but I could, and I knew what you were talking about. So for me, I believe I was born an alcoholic. Like I say, I came from a very loving family and a supportive family, but I never was able to feel that love or really return any of it. You know, I loved my parents, I loved my brothers and sisters, but I was the kind of kid that was just a problem from the word go, and my idea of showing love was being gruff and rough and, you know, a lot of worse things, I guess, with my family. But they continued to welcome me home, and they continued to love me. So today when I look back on it, I know I was genuinely loved, even though I didn't feel that growing up. I had the feeling that I was adopted or something, but I looked a lot like my dad, so, you know, that went out the window as time went on. But, you know, I just really felt different, and I didn't feel like I fit in. And, you know, growing up when I got off to grade school and that type of thing, I felt a different, you know, different from the other kids around me. And so early on, I started to compensate the way I felt and how to fit in with people when I was uncomfortable, because I was always uncomfortable around people that I didn't know, and even sometimes with people I did know. But the way I compensated was to, you know, I saw too many John Wayne movies, I think, growing up or something, but I always was trying to be the rough, tough guy and keep people at bay that way. And it was fear that drove me to that. My life was ruled by fear as far back as I can remember. And most of the time, baseless. There was no reason for me to feel that way, but yet I felt that way. And that kind of thing hung with me throughout school. I, you know, never really felt like I fit in. And I was about 14 years old when I got my first chance to drink. And I went with an older cousin of mine to a party one weekend. And I was out for sports and that sort of thing, and this was right in the middle of a right beginning of football season, I guess. But he invited me along, and I never really understood. Now, he's an alcoholic, too, so, you know, we hung out together quite a bit. Even before he started drinking, we kind of, you know, got along pretty good. But he started drinking probably a couple years before that. He's 3-4 years older than me. And I could never understand why that guy would continue to drink, because there would be times I liked going to his place. His parents were not strict or anything like that. Mine were pretty strict and made me toe the line, or as much as they could. But his parents weren't. Anything went over there, so I liked it. And so a lot of times I'd go out, and he had a farm, and we'd go out there. But a couple times I called him, and I remember talking to his mom and asking where John was, and she wouldn't give me the answer, and finally I'd pry a little more and finally get the answer. You know, first she'd say he's not here, and finally we get to the point where he was, and it was usually something like he's in jail this weekend, you know, that type of thing. And I couldn't understand why that guy would continue to do those same things over and over. And they all related to drinking. He couldn't drive too good when he was drunk, you know, which a lot of us have that problem, and me included. He was really bad. He was always running into things. So anyway, this weekend, he took me along, and I got to tell you that for me, I'll never forget it, obviously. I'm telling you about it now. But it was the first time I got a chance to drink enough alcohol. I drank a little bit here or there, that type of thing, you know, half a beer or something like that from my dad's beer. In fact, he used to have me, he'd say, go on in and get me a beer. Now, he was pretty much a social drinker. He never drank to excess at all. So I'd go in and I'd get him a beer, and, you know, I was wondering about it like a, you know, kid, I guess, typical to a point. So I'd wipe off the top and pop the top for him, and I'd drink it about halfway before the time I got out there. So he quit asking me to bring out beer. But I never, he caught on. But I never drank enough until this night to get the effect that I got from alcohol that night that I chased from that point forward. And I don't know to this day how much it was. They just kept pushing beer my way, and I kept drinking it. And, you know, it was probably 6-8 beers, I don't know, 10-12 could have been. But I got the feeling that I chased from that point forward. Alcohol did something for me that night that nothing else ever had. It took away that fear that I walked around with all the time. It made me feel okay. You know, there were girls there that I couldn't say two words to a girl. You know, we talk about you know, situations that used to baffle us in page 83 and 84 and learning how to handle those through the assistance of a higher power. Well, mine were pretty simple. I mean, if I was walking down the hall, if I didn't have a couple of belts in school, walking down the hall and a girl said hi, you know, before I could get something out, it was probably 30 seconds later. I mean, I just could not talk to people, especially members of the opposite sex, you know. And so, but that night, you know, alcohol did something for me. I was able to do that kind of thing. I was around a bunch of older kids that night, and I was kind of intimidated by a bunch of them. They're all bigger, you know, 4 or 5 years, 6 years older than me. And, you know, I had a few drinks, and all of a sudden something magical happened. They shrunk or I grew, but they didn't scare me one iota. And I loved them. And I could talk to the girls, and I could, I made a fool out of myself the first night, which is kind of typical for the kind of drinker I was, because that wasn't the last time that happened, that's for sure. But I felt good. And not only did I feel okay around you people, it seemed like as time went on and I drank a little bit more, I felt a little bit better. And it did something for me that nothing else ever had. And we were talking about Clancy a little bit earlier, and I remember a thing that Clancy said years ago to me, and he was talking about how, you know, alcohol does something to anybody or anything, any, you know, living creature, including your family pet, if you give it enough beer, which I used to do too. But it does something for the alcoholic. It doesn't do for that so-called social drinker or normal person. And I got to agree with that, you know, wholeheartedly, because I had a physical sensitivity to alcohol. I drank differently from day one, and I drank alcoholically from day one for me. And it was a lot of fun in the beginning. You know, it did the trick. And the little problems that I had, and even some of the bigger problems that I had, I was able to get out of it because of my age most of the time and, you know, the things that happened to me. But what I was always chasing was that effect, the effect alcohol had for me. And it progresses, of course, and we all know that in Alcoholics Anonymous. If it didn't, I can tell you, I can assure you 100% that I wouldn't be here tonight, because if it worked the way it had worked in the beginning for me, there would have been no reason for me to quit drinking. But things started to progress for me, and some of the problems started to happen. When I was about, about a year before I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, I was in another big jam and all the types of things that had happened to me. Before that, I went to high school. You know, I barely got out of high school. And the only reason I even finished high school is I was involved in sports, and that was kind of the motivation for me. And my parents were teachers. That helped a little bit, too. And a kind of a funny story with that. My dad and my grandpa was a professor at the local university in Fargo, at North Dakota State University, and my dad was a high school teacher forever, and then junior high, too, for a few years in there. But anyway, we all had the same name, you know. My dad was named after my grandpa, and I was named after my dad and my grandpa. And that's a nice thing, and, you know, and it's a good thing, until you get a little drunk in the mix, and you happen to be around kids all the time, especially high school. That doesn't go over so big, because when you see Ted Stoa, DUI, you know, in the paper, and then you get to explain that to class, you know, or the school, and that sort of thing. So I know I embarrassed him many, many times over, But anyway, I got out of high school, like I say, and I decided that I was going to, I had scholarships at the time. This is alcoholic thinking for you. I had scholarships to go on to college, and I passed up on everything because I couldn't take it any longer. I had to get away from any kind of, you know, I moved out, and I just had to get off on my own, and I saw school as a real commitment. I thought maybe getting a job and, you know, continue to have money come in so I can continue to drink the way I was drinking at that point in time was priority number one. So I threw that other stuff out the window. Now, you know, you tell a normal person that, and they look at you like, what did you do? You know, they can't understand that. And then I went back years later and paid for it all. So that makes a lot of sense. But that was my thinking. And I went off, and I got, you know, a job, and I started working for, and I'd had some part-time jobs before that, but I started working full-time, and, you know, I'd always had a problem with resenting authority and getting along with people, and, you know, that really started to come, you know, to the forefront for me, and I went from one job to another, all because of my attitude and because of my alcoholism, you know, sometimes just not showing up or not bothering even to come back sometimes. If I missed a couple days and didn't want to hear about it, I just didn't go anymore, and I went and got another job, and that was the kind of thing that I did all the time. It made perfect sense to me. But, of course, that's not being real successful. But anyway, after a, a little bit of time, I got injured on a job, and this is about a year before I got to Alcoholics Anonymous. And at that same point in time, a little bit before that, I'd been in another big fiasco and a blackout where, you know, the whole night I couldn't remember and had done some pretty insane things and some insane behavior and passed out in a snowbank in the middle of nowhere, 25 below zero, wearing my, you know, shorts, my cut-off shirt sleeve shirt, and almost froze to death and didn't remember any of it, but they got me in the car. Somebody tripped over me, found me, got me in the car, got me into a house, warmed up, and, you know, and I didn't, you know, remember anything for hours, except when I finally started remembering something, I was wondering why I was shaking so bad. They explained it to me. But after that, I had to go see an alcoholism counselor, and this is about a year before I quit drinking, and I went and I talked to this lady, and she was really insistent about talking about my drinking, and, you know, she was an alcoholism counselor. She worked in a psychiatrist or something like that. She worked in a mental health unit, and that's where they sent me, and I don't even remember how I got there or who told me I had to be there. But I was there, and I was talking to her about my alcoholism, and she brought out this thing that many, you know, people probably here have, if they've gone through treatment centers, have seen, and it's called the Valley Chart, and it talks about the progression of alcoholism. And I remember looking at that thing and talking about it. She wanted to ask me questions about my drinking, and, you know, even in the foggy state I was in at that time, I knew, don't tell her the truth, you know, lie. So, like usual. And so I did. I set off lying. But anyway, she heard things differently than I thought I was telling them. But anyway, I'm going down this chart. Finally, I got to the point. I was frustrated. And I said, this is it. I'm done. And I just want to tell you this little story about this. But I said, this is it. I'm done. I'm leaving. And she knew the conversation was over. And she said, listen, you got a problem drinking. And I didn't want to hear that. And she said, if you're not an alcoholic, she says, I think you're an alcoholic. And I was 19 years old at the time. And she said, I think you're an alcoholic, you know, judging from the things that she knew about me and what I'd been talking to her about. She said, and I got up even, you know, was getting closer to the door, and she said, but if you're not an alcoholic, then it shouldn't be a problem for you to stay sober for dry or whatever she said for the next 30 days. And I thought, I'm not, and I'm going to prove it to you, lady, you know, that type of thing, and I'll show you. And so I went out of there, and I remember making it for those 30 days, and I was uptight and miserable. For me, right then and there, when I first got to Alcoholics Anonymous, to me, that's what I thought sobriety was. And now, of course, for you sober members of Alcoholics Anonymous out there, if you've been around for any length of time at all, you know that that's not sobriety. What that was for me was just putting a plug in the jug and being dry, and it was that white-knuckle type of situation, which made me more miserable than I was when I was, you know, in the trouble I was having. So, to me, that was nothing that I wanted. And I made it for those 30 days, and I remember going in there thinking, you know, this is really an accomplishment, which, you know, it wasn't a real big deal, but it was to me at that point in time. And I went back to our meeting, and I talked to her, and she said, and this is where I'm going to tell you just briefly about my social drinking career, because it was real short. But she told me, she said, you know, that's great. And so you made it 30. Why don't you try for another 60? And I know I practically fainted on the spot. And, you know, that was not, I already had plans for that night, and they were going to take place. So, in fact, it wasn't really night. That was the afternoon. It was about 5 minutes after I got out that door is where I was going. And so that wasn't going to work. And she knew it right off the bat. And she said, well, you know, if you're going to drink, and I didn't even say anything. She could just read it on me, you know. And she said, if you're going to drink, then you need to learn how to social drink. You need to learn how to control your alcohol consumption. And I said, yeah, I got to do that. And I remember her saying, what you need to do is limit your drinks to 3 or 4. And I said, 4, you know, right off the bat. And so I agreed to that, and I left there. And I remember going, and I was telling my fiancé at the time, and I said, you know, I can have 4 drinks tonight. I didn't tell her about anything more, but she said, I can drink 4 drinks tonight. And so I remember walking out of there and going to the local liquor store and buying Colt 45 malt liquor, you know, the great big ones, and I peeled off 2 reluctantly and put them away and started drinking those 4, and I don't think I drank any more than that night. And I was proven to everybody that I could be a social drinker. And I was out with other friends of mine that night, and, of course, my fiancé at the time, who'd seen all this crazy stuff going on and knew well, you know, how I drank. and what happened when I did drink, you know. Next night, same old story, right back to the races. Could not control my drinking. There was no way. I did not want to be a social drinker. I knew that much. And for me, that once I took that first drink, I had no more control over how much I was going to drink. I really didn't. And it really became apparent to me at that point in time, and for the next year or whatever it was, year and a half before I got to Alcoholics Anonymous. And along the way, a lot of problems. But I went back to school at that point in time. I had been injured on a job, alcohol-related thing, where I'd been crushed in a big machine and almost killed, you know. So I was in the hospital for quite a few weeks with physical therapy and a few other things, all alcohol-related, you know. And I didn't realize it at that time until I got to Alcoholics Anonymous. I started to think about why those types of things happened to me, and I could look back and map it right out, you know, then. But at the point in time that it happened, I didn't really give it a whole lot of thought, other than, you know, I got to recover from this kind of thing. And I was seeing a doctor at the time, and he was giving me a lot of painkiller, which in the beginning I needed. But, you know, I abused it right off the bat, too, you know, and they'd give you the painkiller after I got out of the hospital, and they'd give you bottles of it, and they'd fill that, you know, open prescription or open for a while prescription, and until they start to track that stuff. And this is, you know, some time ago. This is 20, I guess, almost 30 years ago. But so they didn't track it nearly as closely as they do today. But after a while, you know, he started to look at how much of that stuff I was taking. And, of course, I was taking all this painkiller, and I was drinking, and that's all I was doing, really. And for a while, they were just laying in bed doing that kind of stuff. But he started to look at that kind of thing, and then he started to restrict that. And that's where we started to have a falling out, you know, that doctor and I. And I'd come up to his office, and I'd be drunk, demanding more painkiller, you know, and he had his patients sitting around. He was a pretty successful doctor. He had a lot of patients in there, and they'd all be sitting in there waiting for their appointment, and I'd come in and start banging on the counters and all this kind of stuff, and he'd come out, and the nurses, you know, were half scared of me. I mean, just an embarrassment. And of course, you know, I could remember bits and pieces of it, if anything, you know, the next time I came up for an appointment. But the reason I'm talking to you about this is because after my last drunk to date, I ended up seeing this guy because I really didn't know who else to talk to, and somehow, some way, he was informed with the trouble that I was in, and I ended up going up. I had an appointment, and he squeezed me in a little bit earlier, and he talked to me a little bit about my alcoholism. And this guy had a little bit of guts, too, because I was not the kind of guy that wanted to hear about me and my alcoholism. You know, that was not a good subject for me to hear about. And like I said, I always walked around with that rough, gruff exterior, and really that wasn't me. That was fear-driven. But every once in a while, just to make people think it was real, I had to do something like that to convince them. So, you know, I know for him that was probably a big thing for him to do. But I remember sitting in there and talking to him, and he said, you know, I think you're an alcoholic. And he knew I was in trouble up to my ears one more time. And he said, you know, I think what I'm going to suggest to you may get you out of the trouble you're in. Right away in my head, I'm sure it came up a couple inches, because that's what I wanted to hear. You know, that's the kind of thing I always look for, that easier, softer way out that was read about tonight and how it works. That's the way I wanted to look. And so I was looking for that, and I remember him saying that, and I didn't know anything about Alcoholics Anonymous other than the fact I knew it was for old people. I was 20 years old at the time, and I knew I was way too young and way too smart, and I couldn't be an alcoholic. And, you know, and I don't care what age you are, when you start talking about why you're not an alcoholic and rationalizing in your own mind, I've heard all the same things that I was thinking about at age 20, other than sometimes you might not say you're too young. But that's the kind of thing I was doing. I was going, checking them off in my mind. And I remember this guy looking at me and, you know, saying, I think this will get you out of the trouble you're in. And that's what got me. Pure and simple. I'll be honest about it. You know, in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, we talk about a couple of words that have been changed over the years. And one of them was changed about the desire to stop drinking. The only qualification for membership is a desire to stop drinking. It previously had been an honest desire to stop drinking. And you know, when Bill was new in AA, he was really into the spiritual, pious type of thing. And he was going to be an honest desire. And people said, I don't know. you know, and they talked him out of that. And I'll tell you what, that's good, because I had nothing close to an honest desire. I had a desire to stop drinking purely and simply to get out of the trouble I was in. Anyway, he suggested I go to a treatment center. He didn't know anything about AA. For me, treatment was merely a discovery I had an illness. It's that simple, and I don't want to offend anybody with that, but that's exactly what it was for me. Recovery from alcoholism has been Alcoholics Anonymous, and there's never been any doubt in my mind that that's the way it's been. But anyway, he suggested I go to this treatment center, and he said, you know, I think you need to check in, and it should be today, and, you know, and anything. Make a long story short, that's where I ended up. This is the same guy, this doctor, that was able to spot alcoholism in me. I was just barely 20 years old at the time, just shortly after my 20th birthday, and he was able to see that and had seen it, some of the behavior for a year and a half, things that I was doing. But he's able to spot that, and he was able to help me and send me in the right direction. But this is the same guy that was an alcoholic. I didn't know that, and that's probably why I got along with him the way I got along with him. But this guy died of cirrhosis of liver a few years later, 5 or 6 years later. And in between that point in time, never, you know, coming through the door to an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting, to my knowledge, and his family told me the same thing. And in between that point in time of him dying of cirrhosis of the liver, direct result of alcoholism, he ran over and killed a young teenage girl, pedestrian, one night, drunk and in a blackout. Didn't even know he'd done it and had to live the next, you know, few years with that, and of course all the damage that that does with the family and so on and so forth. So, I mean, he's one of those unfortunate, which could happen to any of us, you know. That's so very true, and many times, you know, I didn't know how I got home, let alone whether or not something happened on the way. And I know most of us that those types of things happen. But yet this guy was able to see it in me, and he pointed me in the right direction, and he couldn't do it for himself. And that tells you a little bit about alcoholism, you know. We're usually the last person to figure this thing out. And it is insanity. There's no two ways about it. But for him to spot that in me and put me into the right, you know, pipeline to get me to Alcoholics Anonymous was... I'll be forever grateful, and I told his family that some years later when I talked to him. But anyway, I ended up going to this treatment center, and I can tell you this, that and I'm going to talk about service here real quick, too. But the first time I came in contact with any kind of service in Alcoholics Anonymous, not by me doing, I was on the receiving end, was from other members of Alcoholics Anonymous that came up to this treatment center. And when you're in, you know, and I don't know how many people have gone through that kind of thing, but, you know, it's a confrontational type thing and all this kind of stuff. And you go through it, and I guess it has its, you know, good points. But the big key for me was there were members of Alcoholics Anonymous that came up and not only put on meetings and did those types of things, but spent time individually with me, talking to me. And they didn't say, you're this, you're that, like I heard it, you know, from counselors up there. But they said, this is what I was like. This is what happened to me. And they shared their experience, strength, and hope with me. And that's what made the connection for me to Alcoholics Anonymous. And, you know, and I'll be forever grateful for that, because I don't think for me, because of the fear that I lived with and the kind of thinking I had, would I have made that transition to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous over a period of time if it hadn't have been for those people coming up, talking to me, extending their hand, sharing with me. I don't know if I would have done it. I got out of that treatment center, and for a period of time, you know, I was going to kind of do this on my own and go to AA when the spirit moved me or something. Thank God I didn't take a drink, but it wasn't a short period of time, hit and miss meetings, no regular meeting or anything like that, that I was getting pretty uptight. I hadn't, by the grace of God, taken a drink or done any drugs, like, which was my natural thing, of course, being an alcoholic. When the going got tough, that's what I did. And by the grace of God, I hadn't had to do that. But I was very uptight. I was miserable. Things were getting worse for me. And I wasn't going to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous is really what it comes down to. And they had this thing after this treatment center that they called follow-up. You know, you went to these little group sessions, and they had people in there that weren't alcoholics, and they had alcoholics in there. I would never talk in those things. I wasn't big on sharing. And I remember going to this thing afterwards, but, you know, my fiance at the time insisted I go, you know, type of thing. And so we went. But One night, after this had gone on for some point in time and hit and miss on meetings, I'll tell you, I was more miserable at that point in time than I'd ever been in my life. And I seriously, for the first time, really seriously contemplated, you know, and the last time, seriously contemplated suicide. I really didn't know what to do. I went to meetings and I saw people that were smiling and they appeared to be happy. But I got there about 5 minutes after the meeting started and I was out. When that, you know, ours went from 8 to 9, and at 9 o'clock I was in the parking lot, you know, 10 seconds after. I didn't have any time for anybody, and I was hit and miss. I made no commitment. The pressure was on me, and shortly before that, I was having a problem breathing, in fact. My throat would start to close. I was so uptight and so full of, you know, tension, and, you know, I had no release. I didn't drink. You know, I hadn't taken that drink, and I ended up going to the hospital. They did tests and all this kind of stuff, and the doctor, he had the gall to come up to me after all that stuff, and he said, you know, I think it's nerves. And he hit it on the head. I was nervous, all right. I was uptight, but I thought he was crazy. I thought I was having a heart attack or something. But anyway, shortly after that, I had the night where I really was uptight, and I contemplated the suicide. I contemplated drinking again, and I thought, no, I really need some help here. And I said a quick prayer to a higher power I had no faith in or trust in at all at that point in time, but I said it. And I went to bed, and that next morning I got up. It happened to be on a Wednesday. That night we had that follow-up thing with the counselor and all that kind of stuff, who was a non-alcoholic. And I remember going into that meeting. This tells you about one alcoholic sharing with another. And there was, you know, that night there wasn't any other members of AA there, and there was his counselor there. And he was not an alcoholic. And my wife's telling her, my fiance at the time was telling me, talk to him, tell him the story. So I told him all the things that had been going on, and it kind of poured out of me. And I remember that guy looking at me like I was from another planet. He had no idea what I was talking about. And I knew one thing for sure when I left there, that was the last time I was going to that thing. You know, that was probably the third time I'd been there. But this guy did not understand me and did not understand alcoholism. And the next night was a Thursday night in Moorhead, Minnesota, where I sobered up at the Thursday night meeting there. And I went to that meeting the next night, and I made it. Terrible mistake. I got there early. And I don't even know why, but I was there early. And I remember bumping into this guy, and here's these guys setting up chairs. And, you know, it was a big meeting. It's probably 150 people went to that meeting. Setting up chairs, running all over. I didn't have any idea people set up chairs. I was always there 5 minutes late, and, you know, just grabbed one. Somebody actually made the coffee, you know, that kind of stuff never occurred to me. But anyway, I talked to him for a minute or two. I was pretty desperate, and I remember telling him the same types of things. And he said, you know, I haven't seen you around very often. And I said, no, I haven't been. You know, I was honest with him. And he said, you know, if you're an alcoholic, you don't drink and you don't go to meetings, these types of things start to happen to you. And sooner or later, you drink again. And right away, it seemed like a little pressure was released for me, because I thought, you know, for once, maybe I'm not so different. I don't feel so different. When I talked to him, I felt like maybe he understood me a little bit. And, of course, I got that guy to be my sponsor. A couple days later, I started to spend some time with him, and I found out that, you know, we can talk and we can listen to people, and of course we're all separate, you know, human beings, and we're distinctly different in some areas. But when it comes to alcoholism, our similarities far outweigh our differences, and that's exactly what I found when I got to Alcoholics Anonymous. And I actually started to listen and share with other people and listen to what they had to share with me. That's what I found when I got here to AA. So for the first time in my life, and it didn't happen the first meeting, but sometime thereafter, I started to feel like I fit in and I felt a part of. And there's another little funny thing that goes along with feeling a part of. You know, it requires a little bit of action on my part. Like I said, you know, that meeting I got to was, I didn't get back there to that meeting early for quite some time, probably another month before before my sponsors, you know, was one day I was complaining. I was unemployed at the time, had flunked out of school. I went to five semesters of college, came out with 3 credits, 5 quarters of college, came out with 3 credits, so I wasn't doing well, you know, in school, and I was unemployed at the time, and basically I was unemployable, and I was complaining to him one night. I said, you know, nobody will hire me, I'm miserable, it's a tough day, you know, and it was better than what it had been, but I was complaining, like, you know, and he didn't want to listen to it too much, and he said, listen, quit whining, here's what I'm going to tell you. Come here Thursday night, help us set this meeting up, you know, before the meeting, an hour before, and then help us tear it down, dump the ashtrays, throw away the coffee cups, and start being a part of this meeting. And I kind of grumbled a little bit, and he said, you know, I'm going to make you a guarantee. He said, I guarantee you, if you do that, Friday is going to be a good day for you. And my whole intention at that point was, okay, I'll do it, but I'm going to have a bad day Friday, and I'm going to report it. And because I was always reporting to him every day. But I did this. And I'll tell you something. It's kind of funny. Went out for coffee afterwards, after the meeting and stuff. Got up the next day, was out job hunting, and it was shortly after that I got a job. But next day I was out job hunting and stuff. And it was that night that I was going to bed, and I was thinking, you know, just kind of reviewing my day, as it was suggested. And I started to do that, and all of a sudden it popped into my mind I was supposed to have a bad day today. And I forgot to have one, you know. Things went better for me, and I've never forgotten that. And, you know, we talk about that spiritual awakening and how important that is, and that is a result of the steps, of us working the steps, or me, you know, implementing these steps into my life and taking the actions necessary. And to me, that spiritual awakening is just that, a change in attitude. It's that simple for me, and it has been that simple for me. And my attitude has changed. I mean, I was a negative. I looked at the backs and the bottoms of everything. I didn't see anything positive hardly ever. And if I did, it was brief, you know. I mean, I would turn positive things into negative things. It's just the way I looked at it. You know, and I don't know why that happened to me, but that thing goes hand in hand with alcoholism, I'll tell you that. But it was certainly that way for me. Today, my attitude has changed. You know, I see a lot of positive things. I've gone through some of the things that I've gone through in Alcoholics Anonymous that I, you know, and not had to take that drink and maintained a pretty positive attitude through those things directly as a result of the tools that you have given me in AA and through the grace and the understanding and the love of a higher power. And, you know, for that I'll be forever grateful. But I got this guy to be my sponsor. First day I talked to him, he said, you know, we were driving around afterwards, and we were just talking a little bit. It was the first time in my life I'd ever shared with another human being to that level. Now, I grew up in an organized form of worship and belief, a religion, and this religion insisted that you go to confession and tell a priest your, you know, sins and, you know, that type of thing. And I was never honest in those things. I don't know about you, but... I was never honest, you know. I said what I thought they wanted to hear, and, you know, and then they told you what to do, and I, okay. You know, I'd go out of there, I never did. Even as a little kid, that's the way I acted. But when I talked to this guy, I started to share a little bit about me, and I started to be honest with another human being for the first time in my life. And a funny thing happened. I started to grow a little bit in trust with this other human being. I started to trust him a little bit because he didn't tell everybody what I was telling him. He didn't act like I acted, you know, when I was drinking. And I started to trust him a little bit. And that, for me, was the foundation of a trust and a faith. And, you know, that's a person, you know, a tangible, you know, human being is tangible. And to be able to have faith and trust in this is my own belief, and it's what happened to me in my life, to have faith and trust in the power greater than myself that I choose to call God today, an intangible power, I needed first to have a little bit of trust and faith in another human being, realizing that all human beings are just that, human beings, and have their own shortcomings and defects of character at times. But I was able to do that, and I started to share with that guy about me, and I found out I wasn't so different again, even to a greater degree. Those kind of things happened to me, and I remember that first day he said, you know, if you want to feel clean inside and have good things happen in your life, then you need to follow a few simple suggestions. You need to follow a few things that I'm going to suggest to you. And I wanted to feel clean inside, and I certainly wanted good things to happen, but I remember at that point in time thinking, I don't really care if good things happen. I just want to have the bad things quit happening and getting worse. And I started doing a few things. I thought I'd give it a shot. And this guy went to two regular meetings, so that's what I ended up doing. If he was going to sponsor me, I went to two regular meetings. And he told me about making a commitment to that meeting and making a commitment to be there and to, you know, set up and all that kind of stuff. And I started doing that stuff. And I'll tell you, I am so grateful that I had a sponsor that did that for me and directed me in that way, because I never would have done it on my own. And I never would have got through, you know, the results that I've gotten from Alcoholics Anonymous had I not done those types of things and gotten involved in service. You know, we talk in Alcoholics Anonymous about alcoholism, and I can take a look at myself, you know, how selfish and self-centered I've been all my life. And hopefully today I'm not quite that selfish and self-centered. But growing up, all I could think about was me. And, you know, and of course, I didn't know that at the time. Everybody around me obviously did. My dad, you know, who had thousands of students over the years, told me one time, he said, you know, you're probably the most selfish kid I've ever met. And I thought, oh, yeah, okay, Dad, yeah, right. He was mad at me about something. But I thought about that, and I, you know, some years later, I thought about that. He's probably right. But that is really something, you know. I mean, that's. But today I can see it. You know, on page 62, it talks about selfishness and self-centeredness is the root of our problem. And the first time I read that and heard that, I was in a big book study with my sponsor and a few other AA members. We had them on Saturday mornings and through the wintertime. And I remember the next line says, the alcoholic is there somewhere in that area, that paragraph. It says, the alcoholic is an example of self-will is the extreme example of self-will run riot. I remember reading that, and I'm thinking to myself, and smart enough not to say it out loud, but I thought, not me. And the next line says, though he usually doesn't think so. So you got to read a little faster, I guess, or I did. But but that's so true, and I know that I was. And for me, I've not really totally gotten rid of that character defect, which it was for me, a character defect. But I've been able to turn it around a little bit. I'm still a pretty selfish and self-centered guy. And when John talked about the things that, you know, we end up doing in Alcoholics Anonymous, if we stick around this program long enough, we're asked to do different things. And I can tell you, honestly, I've always done it for selfish reasons. And the reason is because I feel better. And I am able to stay sober. And my life gets better. Because when I do things for you and I don't expect anything in return and I honestly do it that way, then good things happen to me and I get the results. And I've found that it not only works in Alcoholics Anonymous, it works in that big thing called life, you know, that you get out of life what you put into it. If you don't put much into it or you put negative effort into it, you don't get a whole lot back. And you have taught me that in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I like feeling good today. In fact, you know, I don't want to feel any differently. That doesn't mean everything goes perfectly for me, but you've given me the tools and that grace of a higher power that I can handle the things that come down the pike. And so far to this date, I've been able to do that successfully and most of the time positively, and ultimately I've been able to be positive and stay happy and be really what it talks about in the big book, most of the time happy, joyous, and free. And that's a tremendous gift, and it's not something that, you know, that I would have ever been able to get to if it wasn't for people like you that stuck out their hand and not only said, you know, shook my hand, and but showed me by example good orderly direction. And that's exactly what I got with that sponsor. He also said, you know, you don't take that first drink, obviously. Shortly thereafter, I started getting involved with working with newcomers, and I thought about this about a week ago. You know, I was a kind of a sick individual when I got here, and my sponsor, I think I was probably sober 6, 9 months, 10 months maybe, and there was another guy that was probably sober the same amount of time, and, you know, and I remember him taking us out for coffee, and we had a big group, and there was a lot of new people coming in and out of that group, and there was a need for people to, you know, greet people and do these kinds of things and try to sponsor people. And we were both coming up on a year of sobriety, and I remember my sponsor coming out, and he said, either one of you guys sponsor anybody? And we said, no. You know, we didn't know we were supposed to even be, you know, we weren't doing a whole lot of active work with newcomers. And he said, you know, I think it's about time. You've both been sober for a period of time here. I think it's about time you started, you know, really concentrating with newcomers, working with newcomers when they come to AA. Make them feel welcome. Give them the same opportunity in sobriety that you have had. And so that was the first time that I really felt that there might be a little bit of a responsibility, too, along with this deal for me, you know, to offer and give freely what I found. And I started to do that, and we started to, you know, really concentrate and working with newcomers. And I'll tell you, for me, that's where sobriety really started to take on a whole new meaning. When I started giving this thing away freely and directly to that still suffering alcoholic, lots of them didn't take it, you know, but it didn't matter. I still called them, and if they got to the point where they didn't, you know, obviously they weren't going to stick around and do those things, that was fine. There was somebody else along the line, you know, you hope for them the best, but you continue to do those types of things. And I'll tell you, that's where I found the real rewards in sobriety and the real rewards in service. The first sponsoree I ever had, I got out of the local mental health unit. He was alcoholic, but they were treating him for all kinds of other stuff, and he's a pretty young guy, and he had tons of shock treatments, and his name was Jack, and he had so many shock treatments that after he stayed sober, you know, a little bit of time, his nickname became Electric Jack. So, but he was a great guy for me. I tell you, when I first bumped into that guy, and I'd known him from high school, he couldn't hardly say his name. And, you know, there was a period in time in his life because of drugs and alcohol and that type of thing, he was convinced that he was Jesus Christ, you know, like, so he didn't have both oars in the water. But as time went forward, he became, you know, he started to recover, and he started to do a lot better. But I'll tell you something, that guy did more for me probably than, you know, than I ever could have done for him. And for the first year of his sobriety, I contacted him every day. And usually he'd call me, too, sometimes. But I always went out for coffee with him. We always talked. We shared about the problems he was having and all. And it took me out of me. And it took me away from my problems, and they shrunk. And I started to feel like it talks about in page 83 and 84 in some of those problems. Which is I started to feel like maybe I did have a place and a part to play in Alcoholics Anonymous and a part to play in the universe. Maybe I could bring something to it. And, you know, that's a tremendous feeling to have from, you know, feeling useless and full of self-pity and remorseful all the time for things I did, but feeling like, you know, lower than low. So those newcomers really started to help me out. And I encourage you, if you're, you know, new in sobriety, if you've been around for a little bit, that's what it's all about. It's about service. It's about one alcoholic trying to help another. And Alcoholics Anonymous today is in over 150 countries. Same premise, you know. It's the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous is printed in 52 different languages, and the last I've heard, and it works all over the country, all over the world. But if you take a look at alcoholism and you take a look, you know, you hear sometimes the different percentages people give out sometimes in some of these studies about what they feel population, number of alcoholics in the population or percentage, and you hear conservatively 10%. And I truly believe that's probably pretty accurate. And you know, we have 270 million people in the United States of America, and you know, 10% of that would be 27 million members of, you know, potential members of Alcoholics Anonymous. We have 3 million worldwide. So we're just scratching, you know, the top layer. There's no doubt about it. And there's many, many members of alcoholics that never get to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And there's many that do and decide it's not for them and leave, but at least they've had some opportunity in sobriety. I had a brother-in-law, my wife's only sibling, that was an alcoholic. He was a couple years older than her. He had cirrhosis of the liver some time before he passed away, and he put the plug in the jug type of thing, miserable for 18 months. Started drinking again. I had talked to him briefly here and there, dropped him hints, but he was a good bullheaded alcoholic, and you know, and I didn't want to push him too hard and never see him come through the door. But I'd always talk to him about me, and I would talk to him about alcoholism. He thought it was great for me, but he never made the connection for himself. But about 2 weeks before he died, I talked to him because I knew he was in tough shape, and he'd stopped drinking again for about 3 or 4 months. He'd put the plug in the jug again. He was uptight. I could see him physically really going downhill. He wasn't very old. And anyway, I talked to him, and my wife convinced me you just got to be real blunt with him. And, you know, in confrontation, of course, is always the last thing to try, or I found for me. And I did that, but I knew that this was getting to the point where somebody really had to, you know, level with him. And I did. And I talked to him in a very kind way and everything else, but tried to get through to him. Could not convince him to come to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. Told him I'd pick him up and all these different things. He lived in a different town, a couple hundred miles away. He refused to. And within a week or 10 days, whatever it was from that point, he committed suicide. And directly a result of alcoholism. And, of course, you know, that's a tragic thing. And yet, sometimes you can't do anything about it, you know. But there's so many people that, you know, through our public information, through, you know, contacts with your clergy or whatever it might be, that may be the avenue or the way that another newcomer comes your way because, you know, they go somewhere else to get the help they need. And you know, somebody directs them to Alcoholics Anonymous. Work in your local jail systems. We're very fortunate. We have a guy on the board of trustees currently that's a trustee, a Class A trustee, a non-alcoholic. There's 21 trustees on your board of trustees, and 14 of which are alcoholics like us, and 7 that aren't. They're people that have different levels of expertise throughout the country and Canada that are asked to serve. They're friends of Alcoholics Anonymous. We have a guy there that ran the correction system for a number of years in the Justice Department, the entire system for the United States of America. And early on when he came on as a trustee, I talked to him. I was there at that point in time, and I talked to him, and I started talking to him about his experience with Alcoholics Anonymous. And this tells you a little bit about what other people see when they take a look at meetings like this, and they see AA in action. They see a person working with this newcomer. And he said, you know, I was impressed with Alcoholics Anonymous when he was a warden in a prison in Montana or something. He had some contact with Alcoholics Anonymous. And from the first time he saw that working, and he saw members of AA come in and share their experience, strength, and hope with the inmates, and doing things, going out of their way, trying to help another still suffering alcoholic or somebody that was in this institution, he was impressed by it. The other thing that impressed him was it worked. You know, the more Alcoholics Anonymous was introduced, the less he saw of these people coming back in through the revolving door. And he told me, you know, and after that he said, I really started to do a little bit more research on it. And he said, I'm convinced that 90 to 95% of all inmates in all prisons around the country have a drug or alcohol problem. And this is from a normal guy. You know, this isn't one of us saying this stuff. This is somebody that's normal that watches it. He's convinced of it. And so he sees very clearly the need for Alcoholics Anonymous. And so it's worked with those types of institutions, too, on a local basis, local jails, county jails, that type of thing. It's so important. But I got to tell you that, you know, it's not just that. It's the results you get from it, and the fact that we're able to remain sober. But I had a friend years ago that was, a member of Alcoholics Anonymous and for many years, and I remember him saying, you know, don't cheat yourself in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I thought, what do you mean by that? So I asked him, and he said, get involved in AA. Become a part of your group. Start to do a few things. And, of course, your feelings get hurt once in a while. And, you know, that type of thing. Let that stuff go. Try to be a part of. Carry this message to the still-suffering alcoholic. And if you do those things, things are going to get better for you. And he said, don't cheat yourself in AA, because he'd seen many people do that. They were able to stay sober, but they really didn't get the benefits, and they didn't get to the point where they could claim to be happy, joyous, and free, and take a look at the promises on page 83 and 84 of the big book coming true in their life. So, you know, I want to tell you the same thing. Don't cheat yourself in Alcoholics Anonymous. It's a great thing. And, you know, and every once in a while you learn something new. I had, not too long ago, I had a newcomer I was working with, and he gave me a little bit more wisdom, I guess you might call it. He said he was going to tell me what the best measurements for a woman would be. And I said, oh, yeah? And I thought, I wonder what's coming next. And he said, 86, 20, and 104. And I said, what? And he said, 86 years old, 20 million in the bank, and 104 degree temperature. And I thought, you're in the right place, kid. Keep coming back. But, you know, it's a lot of fun. And I guess the whole thing about Alcoholics Anonymous is, you know, when I got to AA, I didn't think I was going to have any more fun. I really didn't. I thought, and when you're 20 years old and looking at a life of, you know, maybe living to be 40 or something like that, you know, an old guy, I'm well past that now, but I just couldn't fathom doing that and not drinking or, you know, doing other food-altering things. I just couldn't see it. I was convinced I was going to be miserable. And I'll tell you something. Shortly after coming to AA, and I was in a group that was pretty vibrant and doing a lot of different things, boy, I'll tell you, I started having more fun than I ever had drinking. I really did. And it was the type of fun that didn't land me in jail and that kind of stuff. I just started having fun with life. And that's continued. And that's been a gift from the members of Alcoholics Anonymous to me and my higher power also. You know, when I was first sober, and of course after I got my sponsor and I started to develop a little bit of trust and faith with him, you know, as time went on and I went through these steps and I started to try to make that conscious contact with that power greater than myself, you know, when I was new in AA, you know, I heard an analogy one time, and it went something like this about when you're new in Alcoholics Anonymous, that faith, you know, that higher power is kind of that big, you know, type of idea in your mind, and that faith is about the size of a pea, you know. And as time goes on, they kind of turn around, and that higher power becomes a much more personal relationship, and that faith becomes much greater. And that takes just time. And it happens to any of us if we do the things we need to do in Alcoholics Anonymous, and we choose to do it and try to make that conscious contact. And today I can truthfully say I have a faith and trust in a power greater than myself. I choose to call that power God, probably because I don't know what else to call it. But I can tell you that I don't go anywhere alone anymore, no matter whether I'm with somebody else or not. That's something that I have gotten by going through the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, becoming involved in service and having a good sponsor. And that's a tremendous thing, because I didn't have anything like that when I got to Alcoholics Anonymous. And I was raised in a religion, and I was, you know, my parents used to pay me to go to church, you know, that type of thing. But somewhere along the line, I didn't get it. And I've since found that when I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, I was spiritually and I was emotionally handicapped. But the thing is that I started to implement these steps. I started to take the actions that were needed in these throughout the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous and take these actions and start to implement them in my life. And I started to recover, and I started to grow up a little bit emotionally, and I started to grow up a little bit spiritually. So it's been a tremendous thing. And I'm getting right here towards the end of my talk here, but I had a couple other things I wanted to say. But in closing, I'm going to talk quickly. I'm going to read page 83 and 84 of the big book, and I mentioned it, and I always like to read it. And for those of you that are new out there, you know, these are the promises that we're given. And this is the written guarantee, I believe, that Alcoholics Anonymous works. And it doesn't say it's going to, you know, just happen to some of us. It says it happens to all of us over time. Maybe not the same, you know, length of time, but will always happen. Page 83 here at the bottom, it says, if we are painstaking about this phase of our development, we will be amazed before we are halfway through. We are going to know a new freedom and a new happiness. We will not regret the past nor wish to shut the door on it. We will comprehend the word serenity, and we will know peace. No matter how far down the scale we have gone, we will see how our experience can benefit others. That feeling of uselessness and self-pity will disappear. We will lose interest in selfish things and gain interest in our fellows. Self-seeking will slip away. Our whole attitude and outlook upon life will change. Fear of people and of economic insecurity will leave us. We will intuitively know how to handle situations which used to baffle us. We will suddenly realize that God is doing for us what we could not do for ourselves. Here's the guarantee. It says, are these extravagant promises? We think not. They are being fulfilled among us, sometimes quickly, sometimes slowly. They will always materialize if we work towards them. And you go a couple pages over on page 88, and one line, and it kind of says it all. It says it works. It really does. And that's Alcoholics Anonymous. And I found that, you know, recovery in Alcoholics Anonymous is not for everybody that needs it, but it's for everybody that needs it that happens to want it. You know, we have to be willing to take a couple of, you know, simple suggestions, one of which is don't take that first drink or any other mood-altering chemicals, and another of which is go to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous on a regular basis. And if you do those few simple things, things get better. And I would like to encourage anybody that's new here, or this might be your first conference, keep coming back. It's a tremendous program. It's a tremendous group of people that you're going to be around. And I would encourage you to stay active and keep coming back. And I just want to thank everybody and say God bless each and every one of you. Thanks for having me back.
We hope you've enjoyed this recording. To obtain additional copies, receive a free catalog of AA and Al-Anon talks, or to find out about our tape and CD of the Month Club, call Encore Audio Archives at 1-800-878-1308 or visit our website at www.12steptapes.com.